It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, a new school year and what changes can be expected in Pittsburgh public schools. Plus, Pittsburgh makes a bid to bring Amazon's second headquarters to the city. But first, Congress back in session. They have 12 legislative days to solve a slew of problems. By the end of the month, Congress needs to tackle everything from finding a way to keep the government running beyond September 30th to dealing with emergency funding for Hurricane Harvey, maybe Irma, to raising the debt limit, to lots of other things. And we're going to talk about all of that as we discuss the 12 days of Congress with Selena Zito, reporter for the New York Post. She covers government and politics. She's based in Pittsburgh. Welcome back to the show, Selena.
Thanks so much for having me.
And on the phone from the Washington Bureau of the Morning Call of Allentown is reporter Laura Olson. Good to talk to you again, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, so where do we start, or even better yet, where does Congress start? Let's begin with Laura. Where does Congress start, Laura?
Well, they got off to a surprisingly fast start this week. There are all these stories about the long, long, long list of things that they had to get done, and you covered a bunch of them. And we actually this morning saw the U.S. House send a bill to the president that will keep the government running through December, early December, December 8th. And it'll raise the debt ceiling long enough to keep paying bills through that date as well. And it includes $15 billion in hurricane aid, which is likely only a small down payment on what's going to be a pretty expensive recovery process. But that actually gets through a pretty decent chunk of the things that they had to do in September, thanks to an agreement reached when the legislative leaders met with President Trump earlier this week and agreed, all right, we're going to do 3 months. And then in December, we get to come back and vote on another round of government spending to keep things going through the rest of the fiscal year. So that covers a good portion of it, though they still have a couple of programmatic things that they need to do to keep the Children's Health Insurance Program going and the Federal Aviation Administration.
Selena?
Well, I mean, I think that it's really fascinating to talk to voters on both sides of the aisle just about what Laura was just talking about. A lot of the sort of reaction you saw in the last election was people tired of the politics of conflict and wanted more of the politics of results. They saw that this week, and they liked it. I talked to voters on both sides of the aisle, and surprisingly, they came together and like, yeah, this is kind of what we want. And so I think since Hurricane Harvey, Congress has wanted to perceive itself more as being functional, as getting things done. And right out of the gate, they did do that. You know, I mean, December might be a holy hot mess, but at this moment, they got off on the right foot.
All right. So do they even use the term stopgap measures anymore? Are they just becoming the norm rather than getting a complete budget done on time? Selena, then Laura, please.
Well, Congress is not normal, but it was sort of designed to be that way. You know, it was designed to move slowly, even though in a fast-paced world and in an interconnected world, that is very frustrating for people. But it is probably the safest way to govern for a country of our size and with this much diversity, not just on race, but also in political beliefs and geographical sort of interests that play. So no, Congress is not normal. It never will be normal. They used to say if pro is the opposite of con, then is progress the opposite of Congress? Yes. The answer is yes.
Laura?
Well, and what we tend to see with these deadlines is that a lot of issues end up getting kind of packaged together, that this wasn't just they call it a continuing resolution to keep paying at the same rates we had been paying, but it also was the hurricane aid, also was the debt ceiling, and so that makes the votes more complicated. You may have someone who isn't very excited about raising the debt ceiling, as some of the conservatives we talked to were a little frustrated with, again, raising the debt ceiling and not doing too much about the size of the debt. But when it gets packaged together with aid for hurricane victims and a do or don't on keeping the government running, then these votes tend to get a little more complicated.
So concerns such as those of Freedom Caucus Chair Republican Congressman Mark Meadows of North Carolina, He had warned the administration to keep the issues separate, the debt ceiling and aid for Hurricane Harvey. Those didn't really go anywhere. That didn't stop Congress today, Selena.
Yeah, and I think I just think it was smart to see this kind of bill passed. I think it's the kind of thing that people have been sort of hungry for. I mean, one of the things that I think Republicans have gotten themselves in trouble with is when you look at how districts are gerrymandered, so that, you know, they're very favorable right now to Republicans because Republicans were in power to be able to redistrict. What happens is you tend to get someone in a seat that is too conservative for the whole region. And then you get members who are members of a far wing like the Freedom Caucus is, and that tends to hurt the Republican Party. And then you see someone like Charlie Dent leave from Lehigh Valley last week or yesterday, and he's a more moderate voice in the Republican Party. And both parties are having a problem in keeping moderate voices within their House seats.
Yeah, and we've done 90.5 has done some reporting this week on gerrymandering, a short series on Pennsylvania's 12th district, which is a fascinating district in itself. So I want to ask you, Laura, about this stopgap. You said to early December. Was there an attempt to leverage any spending cuts at all to raise the debt ceiling?
This kind of just pushes off the fight till December, and we'll see what happens from there. We had heard the president talking about wanting to ensure that there was some funding for the border wall in the spending bill this fall. It seems like that will be then a discussion that we get to push down the line a little bit further. But we also have some things that were added to the list here this fall. Republicans still want to be working on tax reform. We still heard House Speaker Paul Ryan say he wants to pass the bill before the end of the year. And now with the president's decision to end the DACA program, which protects certain undocumented immigrants who are brought here as children from deportation, the president says he wants to end that in March and calls on Congress to come up with some sort of legislative solution to address the nearly 800,000 folks who've been enrolled in that program before then. So they still have a lot to do in addition to any sort of spending bills.
They do have a lot to do. I think tax reform is at the top of the list. I think you'll see them. They have been working on this. They interviewed Senator Pat Toomey this past week about tax reform. He's been sort of one of the lead guys on negotiating this between the House, the Senate, and the administration. He's been working with the administration for several months, so it's not as though they're just like, oh, opening up the door and starting to figure out what can get passed and what cannot. As far as DACA goes, a lot of people that I talk to, especially constitutional scholars, think that while they don't like to see the program ended, they also understood that it was vulnerable. It was probably going to be attacked by the court system and by the attorney generals in several different states and would have been stopped immediately.
Have they filed suit?
They were about to.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think the attorney general from Texas was one of them.
Yeah. And there was a total of 19 of them. I mean, it was about to be completely eliminated. This at least gives it 6 months, and it gives Congress the ability to do what they're supposed to do. This is, I mean, even when President Obama did this, he said this really isn't legal, right? We really can't do this, but we're going to do it until Congress acts.
Well, because he was getting tired of Congress not taking up
I mean, this has been in Congress's lap since 2001. It's 2017. Most people, when they step back and think about their lives, and if they lived in an area where there was poverty or drugs or danger, they would do the exact same thing to bring their children into a place where there are freedoms and liberties and opportunities. People don't want to see children or young adults deported, but they do want to see the border secure. I think they think that is also important.
I'm going to ask both of you, and we'll start with Laura, and it's a follow-up on DACA. President Trump sent a reassuring tweet to the Dreamers, reportedly at the urging of House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Pelosi said she spoke to the president by phone and asked him to tweet to make it clear the Dreamers would not be subject to deportation during the 6 months the president had given Congress to find a solution for them. Let me get your reaction to that. Nancy Pelosi asking the president, and he's doing it. Laura, first you, please.
Well, we've seen a number of instances just this week of President Trump working pretty closely with Democrats on this agreement to extend the government funding and the debt ceiling for another 3 months. That was what House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer were looking for, and he went with their approach as opposed to the approach that the congressional Republican leaders were pushing for. But I did want to add that I think from what Selena has said about folks not wanting to have these children be hurt, I mean, that's what we heard from Republicans when we were getting their reaction to this announcement earlier this week, that it seems like they really do want to find some sort of a solution. We heard Senator Toomey saying these children, they're not at fault and they deserve our support. So having these folks, really their fate hanging in the balance may be something that can kind of spur some action in Congress.
Yeah, and I talked to a lot of Trump voters, too. They're like, if people think that we're, you know, would cheer people to for their children to leave, that's not, you know, that's not at all a high priority to us. Not something that actually we want to happen at all. They do want the border secure, but those are two different issues, and they would like to see this passed and taken care of.
But it seems like voters were going to keep a close eye on what Congress does regarding DACA because of the really massive protests across the country at the congressional home offices of many representatives and senators.
Right. The smartest thing to do would be a standalone bill just on DACA. I don't know if that's going to happen. But, you know, in a perfect world, you know, and we never have a perfect world in Congress, that would be the best approach. Just a clean standalone bill. Let's get the president to sign it. When I interviewed President Trump in May, he also told me during that interview that he doesn't foresee, he did adamantly did not foresee deporting the Dreamers.
All right. I'm going to move on to, because there's so much Congress has to do, and I want to get to your insights. I want to talk about health care, but I want to talk about a very specific part of it first, the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. Covers in Pennsylvania about 176,000 kids. Their families don't qualify for Medicaid, but they're still in need. They're concerned that they could run out of money by the end of the month if Congress doesn't vote to extend it. Advocates seem to be concerned about if this is gets lost in the big battle over health care. Laura, let's start with you. Is there concern? Should people be concerned about CHIP funding going away at the end of the month?
Well, this program is really really separate from the Obamacare fight, and it's one that really goes back further. And Pennsylvania's program goes back even further than the national CHIP program. So there does seem to be a focus on addressing this in its own way, which is a good thing, I'm sure, for advocates, because the fate of any sort of Obamacare repeal just has gotten increasingly unlikely as the month goes on. The Senate's looking at an end-of-the-month deadline if they want to use the procedures that would allow them to pass something with fewer than 60 votes, and even that just seems very unlikely at this point.
So then, do you think they'll keep it separate, Chip, from
absolutely.
The overall healthcare debate?
Absolutely, yeah. You've seen indications on both sides that's not part of this debate. And, you know, there is no sitting member of Congress or U.S. Senate that wants to be the part of something, part of a signage or a cutoff of services to children. You know, that's... Forget about
that's not something you can
forget
run
about
on.
The morality of it. That's just bad politics.
Okay, just have a few minutes left. I want to get your take on the overall Affordable Care Act replacing repealing, because the president has sort of been keeping up the pressure on Republicans to do just that, repeal and replace. But the clock is running out on the special budget rules that Laura alluded to get around the 60-vote filibuster. Selena first, then you, Laura. What do you think we're going to see? Is something going to happen by September 30th overall?
Well, you never know. I mean, I know that sounds like a weak answer, but I'm never quite sure what's going to happen in the relationship between the president and Congress, both Republicans and Democrats. Maybe there is something in the works that Laura might, she's in Washington, she might know better than I do. But, I honestly don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if anything happened.
Laura?
If we see anything this month, it will likely be on a much, much more limited scale. There were a couple of hearings in the Senate this week. The first public hearings that we've held on bringing in some governors, some insurance commissioners from various states, including from Pennsylvania. There's some things that they were seeking, including a guarantee of these cost-sharing payments. There's funding that the government has been paying to lower the deductibles and the out-of-pocket costs for folks who are buying their insurance through the exchanges. And those have been kind of a month-to-month decision. They were targeted by the president, saying he's not sure if he was going to keep paying those. And to be able to provide some certainty for things like that would help kind of provide at least a little bit of stability. And that seems to be the concern that we keep hearing from both from states and from lawmakers, that there just is a lot of instability in the insurance market. And even some minor things that they could do to help shore that up might be helpful.
We have just 1 minute left. So 30 seconds each. What do you that we haven't covered? What are you looking to keep an eye on as far as Congress goes in the next weeks ahead? Let's start with you, Laura, then we'll wrap up with Selena.
Well, we got some big news in the Allentown area yesterday when, as Selena said earlier, longtime Congressman Charlie Dent will be leaving after the session ends at the end of next year. He won't be running again. He's someone who's been kind of a face of the center-right Republicans, and the state will be losing a lot of seniority and a lot of experience from his post. He serves on the powerful House Appropriations Committee. So we'll be tracking kind of what he decides to do with the remaining time he has in Congress and how things shake out in the race to replace him, which will be the third open seat in Pennsylvania this year.
And Selena.
Well, Laura stole everything I was going to say. So I'm still going to keep my eyes on tax reform and DACA. I think that those are interesting and fascinating conversations, and it will be great to see how they debate them. And tax reform will be great for the economy if they get buy-in from both parties. I think that's good for the country and good not only for big business, but it's also good for small business and the people that work for them.
All right. Reporter Selena Zito is based in Pittsburgh, but she covers government politics for the New York Post all around. Laura Olson's a reporter in the Washington Bureau for the Morning Call. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Hamlet, Act Two. What does Pittsburgh Public School Superintendent Anthony Hamlet looking to accomplish in his second year? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The FBI is investigating racist business cards and literature found in the city's Squirrel Hill neighborhood. The cards feature a swastika and noose. FBI officials say they're looking into it, but are also trying to be mindful of free speech rights. And about 40 Pennsylvanians are on their way to Florida to offer disaster relief from Hurricane Irma. They'll first stop in Georgia, where they'll wait for more orders from FEMA. Find more top news at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new school year is underway, and for Pittsburgh Public Schools Superintendent Anthony Hamlet, it's his second year on the job after a bit of a rocky start to his tenure. To look back a bit and look ahead to any major changes in Pittsburgh Public Schools, we've invited into the studios Molly Bourne, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter who covers education. Welcome back, Molly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Sarah Schneider, WESA's education reporter. Sarah, thank you for coming.
Hi, thanks, Kevin.
And you're invited to join the conversation. Tweet us your comments and questions. Please use the hashtag WESA Confluence. No, I'm not going to ask you two to give Superintendent Hamlin a grade on his first year, unless you want to. But how would you assess that first year, considering there was a chance he would never even start it after questions arose, after he was already hired, about the credentials and accomplishments he presented the board? So, Molly, how would you assess the overall first year?
Sure. So I spoke with several people for a story I did earlier this summer about Hamlet's first year, about Dr. Hamlet's first year. And I heard generally good things, that they appreciated his visibility. He was out in the community talking to folks. He was making student voice a priority. He did things like include a full-time nurse on every school campus starting this fall. These were types of things that people really appreciated and really valued. There were some other issues that people had as well, but generally, while I would say he got good marks, I also heard it's too soon to tell.
Okay. Sarah?
Yeah, I would say advocates were definitely happy that he followed through with a couple key initiatives that he was hired for, one being community schools. I mean, that was really pushed by a couple school board members, but he's had success with that in previous positions. So following through with that, I think, was important. And then taking a look at the Code of Student Conduct and revamping that and with a couple important changes to addressing suspensions in the schools, I think, is something that advocates have been pushing for a very long time. And so he's followed through with some of that.
Yeah, I want to get into the suspensions and the Code of Conduct in just a bit. Molly, the Pittsburgh Board of Education did not give Hamlet a letter grade, but they did give him a raise and a bonus after rating his performance as proficient. You accessed the evaluation through a right to know law request. So first of all, do we know what proficient means? And there seemed to be a lack of details about the evaluation.
That's right. They assessed Dr. Hamlet on the same scale they use to assess teachers in Pittsburgh Public: failure, needs improvement, proficient, and distinguished. But the report itself, if you just looked at it, if you remember the public who asked for it and received it, there would be no way to tell what that really means. I interviewed Regina Holly, the school board president,
right,
and she explained that that Dr. Hamlet met the goals that he had set out to do as part of his 90-day transition plan, that's what contributed to the proficient score, and that there's more work to be done in year two, but she wouldn't say exactly what she hoped those things would be, things that she wants to see from him in year two, that it wasn't, it was protected under the law.
So the understanding is that the lack of details in evaluation really isn't unusual, because of the Pennsylvania school code doesn't require details?
The Pennsylvania school code was amended a couple of years ago to require school districts to release goals for a superintendent and whether or not he or she met those goals. And school districts can provide more information. PPS certainly could have said, here are all the board comments, everything else. But Dr. Hamlet's contract also has a line in it that prevents, or that keeps rather, that process confidential.
Okay. I want to move on to what was, you touched a little bit upon what was accomplished during the first year, but I also want to focus on what's planned for the second year. And so what was initiated, do you think, was important during that first year, Sarah? You mentioned the Code of Conduct. Anything else, the transgender bathroom, anything else you thought that could be done quickly that was actually initiated?
Yeah, well, as far as what was initiated, there were a couple things that you had mentioned, but I think the biggest thing that Dr. Hamlet said over repeatedly that this was a year to evaluate the district. And so he did have a report commissioned early on last year, I think that was in November, from the Council of Great City Schools to really assess where the district was. And then he had what he called a look, listen, and learn tour. He went to all the schools and talked to administrators about what needs to happen. So I think that's what he pushed for the first year, that I guess changes are coming now in the strategic plan, with the strategic plan, but he really needed to get an idea of where the district was.
Now, I want to talk about that strategic plan. A lot of the focus was given to him. I believe he released it in April. We spoke with James Fogarty, who's executive director of A+ Schools. he praised the effort that Hamlet made to develop that plan for the district, the community gatherings that you alluded to, Sarah, the look, listen, learn, and meeting with the principals, the teachers, all the stakeholders. But Fogarty also admitted the plan was a bit short on specifics.
We think it's really important for the public to know sort of what the realistic but also ambitious, you know, goals that are going to be attached to the plan. Because as you said, right now, right, there's, you know, move the dial on these issues is sort of what's in the plan. And we want to see, like, well, how far and how fast and what can we know will be success?
All right, Molly.
I heard the same criticism in my reporting for the Dr. Hamlet year interview piece, that the strategic plan didn't seem to be thin on details, that that it wasn't exactly what folks wanted to see. I'll note, though, on the district's website, they have a link to the strategic plan. And then this was new to me. I actually just noticed this, that there's a sort of a list of a to-do list, if you will, and they've been checking off items.
So there's now an action plan for the strategic plan. Well, is that what you're saying?
It seems like it's like sort of like a detailed list within each goal to show, you know, what they're meeting and when. And so I think that will be useful for folks going forward.
Yeah, not a lot of deadlines in the strategic plan, but one of the big issues in the district is suspensions, as we mentioned earlier, and who's suspended, and it's inequitable, and the Code of Student Conduct leaves up a lot of room. It's too discretionary, but there is a working group that was established by the school board, and they are meeting now and supposed to have recommendations to the board by November. And originally that was asked to, you know, implement a K-5 suspension ban by January. They did drop that deadline. And so that working group, that's one of the attainable goals right now.
All right. So the plan, when it was released in April, it outlined some outcomes, including increased proficiency in literacy for all students, increased proficiency in math for all students, ensure all students are equipped with skills to succeed in college, career, and life, and eliminate the racial disparity in achievement levels of African-American students. So, Molly, are there now checklists in those categories, in those goals?
I think that...
Because they're fairly vague, they're statements.
Yes, and I don't think you're going to see necessarily like a checklist for each item underneath those. But one thing that they are doing, especially to address, for example, the need to get kids up to speed on and literacy and math, would be like putting coaches, literacy and math coaches, in some of its most struggling schools, like Westinghouse, for example. That is something that they're going to start this school year. And I think, you know, also we talked about this earlier, the Office of School Transformation is something that Dr. Hamlet wants to create. They were supposed to hire someone to lead that office this summer. They haven't done it yet. So I'll be curious to find out who that person will be. Those people will be focusing on those most struggling schools, and specifically the getting kids at or above grade level reading.
Is that position one of the superintendent's so-called cabinet? He describes it as a cabinet, because I understand that the cabinet is not complete.
It is an assistant. It's called assistant superintendent of transformation, and it really resembles some of his work that he was doing at his most recent post down in Palm Beach County. So I will be really curious to see who that person is. And again, they were supposed to hire that person this summer, but haven't yet.
Okay. Yeah. There's been movement toward changing discipline and suspensions. I want to get into that starting with you, Sarah. But let's hear again from James Fogarty, Executive Director of A-Plus Schools.
My fear is, yes, we're going to put pressure to reduce suspensions because they're disproportionate and it's not helpful to kids, right? But if we don't provide the proper tools to do something different, then we're going to have disruptive classrooms without the tools to actually address the disruption, and then learning is going to suffer, and we're going to do it in the name of reducing suspension.
Sarah?
Yeah, Dr. Hamlet had several listening sessions before they implemented changes in the code of conduct. And that's what came up repeatedly, that teachers wouldn't have the supports they need. And that was a conversation in that board meeting, that a very long board meeting, where they just repeatedly said, we're not ready for this yet. So I guess that's what the working group is supposed to figure out, is how do we do this without having to hire a ton of teachers' aides.
Yeah, they'll be presenting the results of the working group, their results in November.
Right.
So I think you'll see them meet several more times this fall, and but they also want to make sure there are supports available for the teachers to, so they don't just sort of pull the rug out from under them from the outset.
All right, just a few minutes left, unfortunately. I want to get to a couple of things that have to do with student behavior. And let's face it, dealing with that behavior or misbehavior does affect the learning of the individual students. But restorative practices has been going on for a little while now. Is it going district-wide yet? Is it expanding? Sarah?
It's in its third year. And so this was a Justice Department grant for the district. And so,
remind us real quickly what.
Right. Restorative practice is looking at the whole child and what caused the behavior. And it's supposed to address the root problems that are coming from this. And you meet with all the parties involved and discuss who was harmed by this behavior and how do we basically restore that relationship. And so in the third year now, RAND is going to do a study on if this did reduce the disparity in between black and white students and who's being suspended more. And Dr. Hamlet has said that he wants to move this into all of the schools, but so far there's not a plan for that.
So Molly, is that the case that the restorative practices implementing that, eliminating suspensions for the youngest students and trying to avoid suspensions, won't that also help one of the goals of reducing the achievement gap between minority students and white students?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the number of kids and if you look at who these kids are, the ones that are being suspended disproportionately, it is affecting students of color. So I think it's like the results of this study will be really fascinating. I talked earlier this year to the principal at Langley, who now is, I think, in Superintendent Hamlet's cabinet. And he really praised this process. They would start their days with these restorative justice circles, where they're sort of practice circles, where they would just get together and talk about what was bothering them, what was these kids, what was going on in their lives, what they were bringing to school with them every day. And he said it's hard to measure, you know, how that was playing out data-wise, but he felt it was working.
15 seconds each. What will you be keeping an eye on during this school year, Sarah?
I think first the recommendations from the working group on suspensions, but also community schools and how that will play out. That's something that the advocacy groups have pushed for. It means that the school is a hub for social services, so that's really important.
Molly?
I'll be looking at the second year of the partnership with Wilkinsburg and Westinghouse. Also at UPrep, I am really curious to see...
University Prep.
Margaret Malines. I'm really curious to see student achievement trends there come spring.
All right. Molly Bourne is the education reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Coming up, House Republican leaders unveil a revenue plan that's being rejected by some of their own rank and file. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, U.S. Air Flight 427 crashes at Pittsburgh International Airport in 1994. 127 passengers and 5 crew members were killed when the aircraft nosedived to the ground. After an extensive investigation, it was determined that the plane's rudder failed to a point that pilots were unable to take back control. There's a memorial to the victims at Zwickley Cemetery. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for September 8th, 2017.
Yeah. It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Just ahead, Pittsburgh bids to be home of Amazon's second headquarters. But first, Pennsylvania's been without a balanced budget for 10 weeks. In July, Senate Republican leaders reached a compromise with House and Senate Democrats and Governor Wolf on a revenue package, loans, and taxes to fill a $2.2 billion deficit. The House never considered the proposal, and this week, about 18 House members released their own plan. Joining us from Harrisburg is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief, Katie Meyer. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
So, Katie, the plan would transfer cash from so-called special funds that members of this group of 18 or so say have inordinately high balances. So what are these funds?
So these are special funds that aren't necessarily on the regular budget, but they are allocated to various programs. There's agriculture, there's environmental issues, there's a lot of transportation money. And so these things are sort of, they're tied up in grants, they're tied up with, ways of getting money to various programs. There's contracts here for projects. So people who introduced this plan say this won't affect state services. These are legal to have. A lot of other people are saying they do not agree with that. A lot of the programs are saying that, contractually they cannot have this money. The state can't use it to pay its bills. And that if they do use it, there are going to be program cuts. So a little bit of disagreement on what exactly moving this money is going to do.
The representatives who introduced this, what they call the people's budget, complained that the money's just been sitting there. Do we have an idea of why the money has been sitting there, how long it's been there, why it hasn't been spent?
Well, it all depends on the fund. A lot of these funds do have additional monies that are in the budget, sort of, you call them surpluses. But the problem is, that varies by fund, what these surpluses are for. I'm talking to lots of different agencies now, and they're saying, some of these surpluses aren't really surpluses. It's just funds that haven't been used yet, that have already been allocated for various projects. So, it's been there different periods of time. A lot of it does recur every year. There's also certain funds where, it's tied up with federal obligations, and so they have to keep a certain amount of money in the fund in order to keep getting federal dollars. So it really is, it's all over the board, and it's a very complicated thing to go through and, figure out where all this money is supposed to go and where it's coming from. And so they did do a lot of work on this, but a lot of people in the administration are saying they didn't talk to the agencies that get the funds, and so there really is, this is a very complicated thing that they're trying to do.
You spoke with Republican Representative Dan Maul. He is from Adams County. Let's take a listen.
Until every source of reserve revenue is exhausted, we should not ask more of our taxpayers.
All right. Seems to be some logic there. Use what you've got, and then if you don't have enough, go to the taxpayers. Seems to be logical.
And the real debate here is, do we actually have this money? Is this money that we can take? Maul and a lot of his conservative co-workers say, we can take it. A lot of other people aren't so sure.
Isn't there a question being raised that whether it's constitutional? Because the legislature itself actually passed or accepted the money to put it into these funds, and then they would be, under this plan, taking them out of already designated areas.
Yeah, there are constitutional questions. There's just broader legal questions about whether or not you can break some of these contracts. Or whether, transferring the funds out, if it's surplus money, would in fact break a contract. And so everybody's sort of scrambling to figure out exactly what's going to happen. But, before that even happens, we have to see if this will even pass the House. And, a lot of supporters say, they can rally the votes for it. They can get the votes. There haven't been any vote counts yet. They were supposed to, whip the members, tally those votes at some point soon. But I don't know if that's happened yet. We haven't heard anything. So, there really are some people, more moderate Republicans, people in the southeastern part of the state where a lot of transportation dollars go, who really are very conflicted about voting for this plan.
Okay, we're starting to run out of time. So what are the chances of that vote? Because I believe the Republicans have, what, about a 38-seat edge in the House.
Yes.
They're going to need most of their rank and file to hop on board because the likelihood of any Democrats slim.
Yeah, it's going to be really close. They're going to, I mean, I think we're going to hear about it, whether or not it dies in caucus next week when they come back. It's really anybody's guess at this point. Again, they haven't tallied the votes in any way that I know about, that we've heard of. So, you know, they're going to have a challenge on their hands to get this out to the full House.
So one of the other criticisms is that this is, you know, this is a one-time use to plug this hole. But, you know, our governments are used to using one-time sources to fill holes. But the question, and so therefore there's no dependable revenue stream for next year to pay for things. But I'm wondering, is there anything floating around Harrisburg that maybe this is what some of the conservative Republicans want? That therefore there's the argument that, okay, next year, we'll just have to cut spending because we don't have the revenue stream.
Well, that's certainly what a lot of the conservatives are saying. They are saying that, by the way, that this plan could rally up some recurring revenue because there would be actual redirections of funds. So, like, that it would come back year over year. Now, again, there's controversy about whether or not that could actually happen. But, yeah, these are a lot of one-time revenues. They say that's okay because a lot of this is a one-time expense. It's shortfall from last year. And, you know, if they can pay for that, maybe they're on better footing for the next years coming in the future. But, yeah, there's really, it's, a lot of people have said, you know, we use these one-time funds year over year to plug up these holes, and that just makes us in worse shape later.
30 seconds, Katie.
Sure.
Do you think this will even come to a full House vote, the plan that was introduced this week? And I'm asking you to be a prognosticator. If it does, where's it going?
If it goes to the
full House,
to the full House, and even the full House passes it, the Senate has said it has real reservations about this, and the governor does not like this plan. So the odds aren't great that this is going to be the final one.
Katie Meyer is WESA's Capital Bureau Chief in Harrisburg. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you.
Amazon is offering $5 billion and up to 50,000 high-paying jobs to one city, a metropolitan area interested in hosting its second North American headquarters. CEO Jeff Bezos called it the Amazon HQ2 Challenge, and Pittsburgh wants to win. Joining us is Tim Schooley, reporter for the Pittsburgh Business Times. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
All righty, Tim. Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto announced his intention to bid immediately, first thing in the morning, right on Twitter. Tim, what could Pittsburgh offer, something specific to this, the Steel City maybe, that could put us ahead of other contenders?
Well, there's been lots of technology companies coalescing here, and I'm sure that has to be appealing, as well as all the robotics activity going on here, which Amazon is largely involved in with a lot of its initiatives. So there is a logic for them coming here.
So Amazon has this big wish list that they want for this second headquarters city. Population's greater than 1 million. Well, Metro Pittsburgh, okay, Allegheny County. Capable of supporting a stable and business-friendly environment. Needs to be near an airport, mass transit. And they want between 500,000 and 8 million square feet. So do we have space for that? I know you've been keeping an eye on Almano, and that seems to be the place that's popping up. Do we have space for it, first of all?
The question is, how do you program some of these sites to be able to build higher if need be? Almano would seem like the most likely site in the city. The 28 acres could only host that if you were to build a couple towers there, and that's not what's been approved by planning. That could be changed. But my understanding that Almano, their plan calls for 3 million square feet of commercial development. They've got, it's 178 acres total. They have 88 acres that is fully developable. And I'm told that they could build higher than that if need be. If how much it could get up to 8 million square feet or what it would take to do that, I'm not entirely sure. But Almano would seem like Peduto's best bet within the city.
Oh, yeah. Would that be a stumbling block, changing what has already been approved as far as height and the towers? Do you see that as much of a stumbling block?
I mean, it adds time. I mean, it would definitely add time. Whether you would describe that as a stumbling block, I don't know. You know, obviously, if you have somebody like Amazon comes in, there's going to be a lot more motivation to alter things. But it could be a stumbling block.
Okay. So Amazon wants the site to be close to an urban center. Would El Mono count?
El Mono's all but in an urban center, so it would count. It would count better than a lot of places.
Yeah, we're only a couple miles away from downtown, practically, right? A
couple miles away from downtown, and just down the hill from Oakland, where Amazon would likely want to hire employees, and where Amazon has already bought a couple companies and help motivate them to establish an office here to begin with.
All right, let's hear from CMU entrepreneurship expert David Mawinney. He talked with producer of The Confluence, Megan Harris. You got a few reasons why he thinks Pittsburgh is the perfect fit for Amazon.
Amazon is the number one recruiter at Carnegie Mellon now. It recruits more students from multiple programs than any other corporation, right? So there's already a deep relationship here. Amazon put an office in Pittsburgh this last year to be closer to our artificial intelligence capabilities. And we are also the number one robotics startup ecosystem in the world, and they need robotics to automate their warehouses.
So he's talking about two smaller offices, one in the South Side, another in Ferrywood. Tim, what do you think? Does bringing a company such as Amazon make a difference to other tech entrepreneurs? Would that act like a magnet?
Oh, of course. I mean, the companies that were bought by them would certainly suggest that other companies that work in similar fields would be motivated by having Amazon nearby as well. It has to.
Okay. So, transportation hub. We mentioned mass transit. Do you think
and the lack thereof?
They're still trying for bus rapid transit, and that's it. But that would make an improvement. Do you think that's where the Pittsburgh application might suffer? Because you said near the urban center. Airport, not all that far away, but do you think this is where the application could suffer?
It could be a challenge from the standpoint of available flights at the airport, although Amazon bringing that many people in might inspire airlines to add more. But the El Mono site definitely has some access challenges, and it will need more transportation to make it viable. So that will be something that will have to be tackled for sure.
And while the airport's not that far away, it's not a hub anymore, and not likely to be so. And of course, Christina Kasotis, the CEO of the Airport Authority, said she's not interested in pursuing that. I do want to ask you about the application and what the mayor said he plans to do. This is something you're very familiar with when you covered the application for the Smart Cities Challenge, which Pittsburgh lost out to Columbus. He said he planned on sort of borrowing some of the ideas from the Smart City Challenge to put into this application, because they did get some positive feedback from the feds on the Smart Cities Challenge. So,
and they were a finalist. So.
Yeah. So how do you think this could play into that? What might be applicable in this proposal by the city?
Well, just the process of working with all the different interests in the city to team together to be able to pursue Amazon as a whole. You'll need the influence of Carnegie Mellon to do that, I'm sure. You'll need an all hands deck approach in terms of the different governments and institutions that will help for that to happen. I think that's probably the biggest thing. In terms of the specific components of the Smart Cities Grant, sure, just the city having done that and presenting the technology it's been able to enhance here, that all helps as well.
So, deadlines. When do we know anything about when Amazon might make a decision? When does the city have to officially apply? Who might be competitors? Would Pittsburgh really even be in the running?
I haven't seen anything super specific on deadlines. I think Amazon, what it posted on its website, I think put next year. But I don't think there was like a month yet. So I think that's still largely to be determined. Whether Pittsburgh is seriously in the running, I don't know, but there's been a number of national publications that have put Pittsburgh in the running for it. I guess I would wonder what their geographic priorities are, if they'll want to be someplace close to the East Coast in terms of, you know, the population density there. We'll have to see.
All right. So choosing a city in 18, supposedly, maybe construction in 19. Tim Schooley is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Business Times. Tim, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley. Production assistance from Courtney Harrell. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good week of good news.